Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second plenary of the Equinox Summit Energy 2030. My name is Wilson De Silva, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Cosmos, Australian Science Magazine, and I'll be chairing the serving as host and moderator today during the summit plenary session. In the first four rows of this theatre, we actually have 40 people, scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, and future leaders, who are working to create a joint vision on the transformative technological solutions we will need as a society over the next 20 years if we are to move beyond a carbon-intensive energy world and towards a cleaner and more sustainable energy future. Every morning, we will begin with a public plenary session like this one, in which four summit scientists will propose innovative technologies and approaches with the potential to transform our energy system. Each of them will deliver a 10-minute presentation arguing their case. Today's session is called Waste Not, Want Not, Investing in Efficiency. Following the presentations, we'll explore the ideas in a panel discussion and an audience Q&A. But first, let me introduce you to our summit scientists. Linda Nazar is the Canada Research Chair in Solid State Materials and a professor in the Department of Chemistry and the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Waterloo. She is passionate about shifting how we look at energy to deal with climate change. Gillian Buriac is the Canada Research Chair in Nanomaterials and professor in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Alberta. She is working at the nanoscale to create cheap and powerful solar cells. Alana Spiro-Guzik is an associate professor in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Harvard University, and he's a pioneering chemist working on the next generation of solar technology. And Kathy Foley is Deputy Chief of Science at the Division of Materials Science and Engineering at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, CSIRO, in Australia. She's a physicist whose work in superconductivity could lead to technological leaps in how we produce and distribute electricity. But before we start, we'll take a look at a short video that identifies some of the problems with the way we currently distribute electricity. Let's take a look.
Generating electricity is the first link in the electrical chain, but delivering it efficiently and using it effectively are both difficult. Most would agree that the incandescent light bulb was a brilliant idea. Simple, elegant, and, of course, illuminating. But this brilliant idea also has a dark side. If coal is the fuel burned in a power plant, fully 65% of the energy is lost right at the source. Another 3% is lost during transmission to your home. Of the energy that does reach the light bulb, almost all is wasted as heat. Less than 2% of the original energy from the coal is actually converted into light. To light just one 100-watt incandescent bulb around the clock for a year, you have to burn a third of a ton of coal. Coal that has to be mined and shipped to the power station, requiring even more energy. By switching to a compact fluorescent bulb, we reduce the amount of energy required. But the bulb is still wasting 30% of the energy it draws as heat. No matter which light bulb we use, underlying inefficiencies in our system contribute massively to the CO2 problem, such as phantom power loss. Electronic equipment in our homes and offices that are on standby, like TVs, stereos, and computers, are using energy every minute of every day, collectively pulling a full 8% of available electricity out of the grid. We are wasting energy as heat, using energy we don't really need, dissipating energy through the grid, and losing energy at the source. Right now, the world is struggling to produce 22 trillion kilowatt hours of electricity each year to power almost every aspect of our lives. By 2030, we could save more than 50% of our CO2 emissions just by plugging the inefficiencies. Energy that could be used to help satisfy the world's growing demand for power. What we need now are brilliant new ideas to shed more light on how to become more efficient and find much better ways to produce, deliver, and use electricity.
Well, that's the overview. Let's hear from Linda Nazar on how we can address efficiency through storage. Linda.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome. I'm going to be talking about how energy storage plays a role in managing our energy demands today. And I'm going to, you've heard many times during this meeting already, I think, that we are having CO2 emissions are not being held to the targets that we would like. This is just an article from the BBC News pointing out that we are now edging close to the level of emissions that should not be reached until 2020 if this 2 degrees centigrade target is to be attained, which we heard about on Sunday. And so there's a prediction with 85% certainty that we're not going to limit this global temperature rise. And at the same time, those who have a vested interest in oil are not particularly keen on us finding alternatives, not to diss the Saudi prince, but he is on record, this is the CNN news, is saying that we don't want the West to go and find alternatives, because clearly the higher the price of oil goes, the more they have incentives to actually do this. So what are these alternatives? Well, we've heard about them already. And they coupled with energy storage, are part of the solution to mitigate CO2 emissions. So this is what we often call a CO2 cake, which can be divided according to the electricity transport and heating contributions. And this CO2 cake, the electricity portion effectively, can be minimized if we incorporate solar, wind, and wave type technologies, which you'll be hearing about later. But these are fundamentally intermittent. They need storage to back them up in order to do what we call load leveling. And it is literally absolutely critical in order for these to work. And also important, of course, is the electrification of transport, and that is to mitigate urban pollution, CO2 emissions within cities. But more importantly, if the electricity can be generated elsewhere, CO2 capture can, again, mitigate those CO2 emissions, which, of course, is impossible to do with vehicular transport. So then, in short, all of these aspects, both renewables and also electrification of transport, depend on efficient, low-cost energy storage. And low-cost is particularly important and cannot be overemphasized. So I'm just going to produce a little video to show you how a lithium-ion battery works, because I am predominantly going to be talking about lithium-ion technology today and contrasting it with a new kind of technology. So in this little video, we have energy versus capacity, that is how much electrons can be stored, plotted on the right. And on the left, coupled with this, is the little picture of what goes on in your laptop battery every time you plug it in and recharge it. So the lithium ions move between a positive electrode and a negative electrode during the charge and recharge process. So if you follow along here, this is the discharge process, and the ions are now shuffling into the layered oxide on the left. And on charge, where you have it plugged into the circuit, you're moving the system uphill, and you're now putting those lithium ions into what we call a layered carbonaceous material in the negative electrode. And so this process repeats itself many, many times as you continually charge and recharge your cell. And we are effectively then running the system downhill when we use it to run our laptop or our automobile, and we're running it uphill when we do the charge process. So these systems are, of course, very well known for portable electronic devices, but for large-scale storage, we need a different kind of cell, and in particular, we need really safe batteries. So oftentimes I'm asked, what's wrong with you people? Why can't you build us a better battery? And part of the problem is that it relies on chemistry, unlike Moore's law, which is sort of based on physics, and chemistry can be very difficult. So I'll just briefly address a few materials that really are starting to make a difference. We call these Generation 2 materials, and they include a range of literally minerals, one of which is called triflate, charming name, otherwise known as lithium iron phosphate. And you can find this in your local store in the form of power tools, because it's being used to power most of them these days. And it has this structure, which I'm showing here on the right. And many of you are not chemists, but I'll just point out that these little red items are iron octahedra. So we have an iron atom surrounded by six oxygens. And these are linked up with the yellow phosphate tetrahedra, where we have a phosphorus surrounded by four oxygens. And this entire structure forms channels in which the lithium ions can move back and forth, one-dimensional transport. And so when you remove all of the lithium from the material, you what we call charge the battery, you take it up to its higher oxidized state, and this is a completely reversible process, and you can actually extract all of the material, the lithium. And you're extracting not just lithium, but the electrons as well. So the reason this material has become so popular is, for reasons that I won't go into because I don't have time, it is a particularly safe material, unlike many of the systems that are the components of the laptop, which in a large scale can cause issues for both long-term storage, for vehicle storage, and also for large-scale storage. So this material has been implemented in plants such as shown this. There are companies that develop energy storage systems based on this material, and they're currently available to global markets in about the 100 milliwatt hour range. And these materials are also being used to power cars, for example, in China. BYD has quite a fleet based on this material. So this is a new development, and there's all sorts of other exciting developments. This is just the first one. There's a whole range of members of that family. So I think it's also safe to say that between 1991 and 2000, engineering effectively was responsible for increasing the energy density in most of the batteries that we know. Between 2006 and some indefinite time in the future, new materials are going to govern the increase in energy density that we all hope to see. But then there's beyond the horizon that we have, of course, difficulty predicting, but we have some ideas about how we can actually improve the capacity of these cells. And I'll just briefly touch on a few of these. One is to turn to sodium ion technology. This is specifically for coupling to renewable energy. It won't be coming to a vehicle. I think some of you may have seen this article in the BBC News about the fact that lithium source resources are somewhat limited and somewhat localized in the world. So Mitsubishi estimates the demand of lithium is going to outstrip supply, which means really that the price of lithium will go up, but others disagree, so this is a matter of some contention. But lithium certainly is available for electrical transport. As for coupling to renewable energy, sodium is probably a better choice. So for example, we have developed a sodium material which looks a lot like that lithium iron phosphate I told you about, except it has sodium instead of lithium. And the part of the problem is that sodium is a large ion, so we have to be very careful about constructing our materials such that we take that into account, because the sodium doesn't move so easily in the material because of its size. And volume change between the charged and the discharged material are always important, because you don't want those to be expanding and contracting in your battery. So this is a material which we call low strain, and it functions quite well. It has the structure shown on the left. So where do we go beyond that? And one of the gleams in everyone's eyes these days is in lithium sulfur and lithium air batteries, because as shown in this plot of energy density versus a variety of different materials, it really does offer the potential for substantially increased gravimetric and also volumetric energy. So gravimetric is per gram, volume per volume. And these just show some of the common materials. This is called a nickel manganese cobalt, and it is the material that is in most of your laptops or will be soon. These are some new materials that have been developed by Panasonic. This is the material that's in the Chevy Volt. This is the one I spoke of, which is in a lot of solar energy panels as energy storage. And this is where we would like to go. So I'll tell you a little bit about how we're going to get there. The chemistry that I told you about with the lithium iron phosphate is called intercalation chemistry. And it comes from inserting days into a calendar, literally, to intercalate. And so it is fundamentally limited because you can only insert so many of those ions and so many of those electrons into the material. And so that chemistry then is described here. But if we go back many, many, many years, decades, we are in fact beyond that, to lead acid batteries, they operate with reactions in the bulk. And that is effectively what a lithium sulfur battery does. And I compare here a lithium sulfur battery, a lithium air battery, and a fuel cell that most of you are probably somewhat familiar with. So a fuel cell combines oxygen at one side and fuel on the other, and it produces water, which is eliminated from the cell. A lithium oxygen battery combines oxygen, which comes from outside, with lithium at the other side. So the lithium is acting as the fuel effectively. And it produces a peroxide, which is stored in the positive electrode. And then moving to the left, a sulfur battery is somewhat similar, except the sulfur is stored on board. And it reacts with the lithium from the negative electrode to store the lithium sulfide on board. And this technology has been known for decades, but it really hasn't worked very well for a variety of reasons. But it does offer the potential of five-fold increase in energy density compared with a lithium-ion battery, where, as I said, a factor of about two-fold has been reached in the last two decades by a combination of materials and technology. And lithium-air batteries, which are very contentious, shall we say, offer even more promise, but they a lot more problems as well. So I'll just tell you a little bit about the sulfur battery before I end off today. Our approach to the problem, and we worked on this with Toyota, was to take a carbon which has little pores, and these are in the order of 4 nanometers, which is very small. And these pores then act to electrically wire up the sulfur, because most of you have seen bulk masses of sulfur know that it's an insulating material. It's yellow and highly insulating. So the sulfur is incorporated into this material simply by melting it, and it incorporates into this structure by capillary forces. So now effectively we have a whole set of wires embedded into this insulating mass, and on that nanoscale the electrons can find their way to the sulfur within a fairly short space. Thus, it works very well for electronic wiring. It also works well because as soon as the sulfur starts to go into its discharge state, it produces intermediates, which unfortunately can actually escape from this mass. But when they are completely encapsulated by the carbon, they are effectively hindered in that escape process. So the sulfur is incorporated into the material. That's what acts as the positive electrode. And we have fairly high levels of sulfur in our material. And when we discharge the cell to form the lithium sulfide that I told you about in the previous slide, we have the system designed such that the product completely fills that porous structure. So we go from one in which we have a little space left for expansion and one in which it fully expands to fill the space allotted to it. And that also provides intimate contact between this, which is also an insulator, and the carbon. And so hence the material is rechargeable and it works reasonably well. So we're still in, this is sort of generation three systems. We have good conductivity in the material similar to that of the carbon itself. And we have been able to maintain capacity. This is a plot of capacity versus cycling number, and this is over 100 cycles. And so we're able to attain 900 milliamp hour gram capacity. Now, compared with the lithium iron phosphate that I told you about, which is 170, that's a big increase, 170 to 900. However, this material, the voltage at which you store that capacity is a little bit lower than the iron phosphate, which is at 3.4 volts. And voltage times capacity gives you the watt hour, the actual energy density in watt hours per kilogram. So this works out to be about 1,300 watt hours per kilogram based on the total mass of the electrode, and then if we count all the other cell components, we estimate about 600 to 800 watt hours per kilogram for a full cell. And that's where I got that number on the plot that I showed you. So if we compare that to a typical lithium-ion cell, which is at about 150, again, we have about a five-fold increase in energy density. And we and many others around the world are working on this technology to improve it. As I said, it's a third generation type cell. We estimate probably that it's going to be 5, perhaps more years before we work out all of the bugs. So here I just summarize where we have been and where we are going. With the point that gasoline at the bottom is, of course, you know, it's hard to compete with, but we have to at some level. And there isn't one solution to all of these problems. So this table is in the energy density in either watt hours per kilogram or in millijoules per kilogram if you prefer. So these are the commercialized technologies that I was describing, or some of which I was describing. And you see as we've gone from lead acid with 35 watt hours per kilogram to NiCad, nickel cadmium batteries at 45, to sodium sulfur. These are high temperature batteries that operate on a fairly different principle, which is about 80 watt hours per kilogram. We finally got up to lithium iron now with roughly 130 to 150 watt hours per kilogram. So the question marks that I have for these materials are because we can't really estimate that energy density unless we have a fully commercial functional cell. So we're estimating 600 for lithium sulfur. A company called Scion Power has actually not yet commercialized, but developed commercial size modules of lithium sulfur batteries, but they operate on a different principle than do ours. And they provide at 350 watt hours per kilogram, and they also say that they think that they can get to 600. They have a lower volumetric energy density. This is where a lot of people are going in the future, to lithium oxygen or lithium air batteries, which, as I said, present a great range of problems. And there's all sorts of other technologies under the sun which are extremely appealing, one being, for example, magnesium sulfur, which is another gleam in people's eyes. So I think it's safe to say that when people say, why haven't you built a better battery for us? Well, we have. We're just, it is, as I said, a complicated process because the chemistry is really tricky. And you have to combine all of the different elements in the cell, not just one electrode, but all the components of the cell in order to really achieve progress. So we're working on it. And so I guess then to summarize my 2 minutes. Yes. So we've gone from systems where we work with bulk intercalation systems. This is the material that is in your laptop or something close to it. So this is what drove technology in the 1990s when it was first developed. And it is effectively what has taken us in some form or the other to the present day. We've moved from that bulk intercalation system where we have large masses of material where ions and electrons are moving in and out on the charge and the discharge, to systems which rely on what we call nano-intercalation. In other words, very small little pieces of matter in which we have carefully tailored designed the systems in order to make them work well. And I told you about lithium iron phosphate being one of these materials. This is a solar panel in China that is has a whole lithium bank of lithium phosphate cells behind it in order to store the solar energy. And these are some large-scale systems based on that material. And recently, within the last literally 2 or 3 years, a variety of companies have come out with batteries based on nanotechnology, including Panasonic, Sony, and Altair, all of which have employed them mostly at the negative electrode to replace the carbon. So now we're moving, I believe, into this system where we call, I call nano-integration, where we combine materials that aren't even conductive with conductive materials at the nano level in order to allow them to work. And they do work. And this then ultimately may be translated to more complicated materials in the future, where we have to create complicated architectures on every scale, the nano, the meso, and the micro, in order to really make these cells work. And that's all I have to tell you about today. And so thank you. I think I have an acknowledgement slide. No, it didn't make it in. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. Wrestling with chemistry and physics there to make storage work. Now we have Gillian Burak, who's going to tell us about the personalization of energy.
Thank you very much all for being here. I want to tell you about energy usage in the present and energy usage in the future. And so I'd like to tell you about power for 1 times 10 billion. These are just a few examples of some of the solar cells that we make in our lab. I'd also like to say that we have a startup company called Light Power, and these are the three graduate students who have started this, who just won an entrepreneurial award in Alberta. So where are we headed? And so I think this is a very important plot to look at. This is a plot of gross domestic product versus primary energy usage per capita. And as you can see from this plot, there is an obvious general trend that as a country becomes richer, its energy usage per capita also increases. And so it's important to realize that right now, of the current, say, 6 or 7 billion people on the planet, half of the population is living down here. And with this half of the population very interested in increasing its standard of living, for obvious reasons, that primary energy usage is also going to increase. And so we expect also a linear increase. And so you can go, next slide. So you can look at this in a number of different units, and I'd like to define one unit. And I know this is kind of like my most boring slide, but let me define a terawatt. So a terawatt, Thank goodness for the computer industry, because everyone now is familiar with what a megabyte is, and that's 10 to the 6. Giga is 10 to the 9, and tera is 10 to the 12. I remembered in high school learning, my God, the piano exploded, as the way of being able to remember this. And so when you think about it, a terawatt is 10 to the 12 watts. And so we're used to thinking about watts in terms of light bulbs. When you go and buy a light bulb, you're always thinking, is it 100 watts or 20 watts? And so a nice way to consider it is that the Earth is a 14 terawatt light bulb always left on. We are burning at any given moment 14 terawatts of power. And power a watt is joules per second. So at any given time, 14 terawatts are flying through the system. So there you go. A lot of energy. And so when you think about where this power comes from, these are 2,000 numbers, but they certainly haven't changed much, is that the vast majority of the energy that we use, the power that we burn, comes from what we call legacy sources, fossil fuel sources, oil, gas, and coal, with small amounts from biomass. And actually, the vast majority of this biomass is not what we consider like ethanol and things like this. This is actually people getting wood and finding other non-renewable sources, really, of biomass and burning it for heat and cooking and things like this. Hydro, nuclear, and renewable also contribute small amounts. So I'm not going to bore you with this very long set of calculations, but this comes from this beautiful PNAS paper from 2006 that you can look up, where they look at where energy usage is going to go in the future. And so through simple calculations, as they looked at what the increase of GDP is expected to be per person, and doing a number of calculations, and like a bank account that's not producing a lot of interest, 1.5% increases per year, if you just leave that bank account, eventually it starts to increase, and that's exponential growth. And so what you're finding is that based on the most conservative numbers available, is that we're going to need somewhere between 28 and 35 terawatts of power. And that's a lot of power. Again, we're using somewhere between 13 and 14 terawatts right now. So our energy usage is going to more than double by 2050. More than double. And by 2100, by 2100, these numbers are expected to triple and perhaps quadruple. This also takes into account the very large amounts of conservation. So this is unprecedented conservation is included in these numbers. So this number of 30 terawatts or so is actually a very conservative number. It could be far greater if we don't conserve. So where do we find these tens of terawatts? In fact, Dan Nocera of MIT calls this the missing 16 terawatts. And of course, we like it in a carbon neutral fashion, so let's consider some sources. So down here, just if anyone's from the oil and gas industry, we're not going to take away your job. We'll just start with that. Okay, so we leave the legacy fossil fuels there. You think about biomass. If you were to take all the cultivatable land on the face of the planet that's being used right now for growing food, that will generate between 7 and 10 terawatts. So you'll have enough energy to turn on light bulbs and drive your car, well, at least part of it, but you're not going to eat. So all the cultivatable land for food. If you take all the 300 million hectares of the United States, use the most productive crops, miscanthus or sweetgrass, and you convert that into fuels, that'll generate 1 terawatt of power. You won't eat, but you'll drive. Nuclear. You'll need by 2050 to build 8,000 new nuclear power plants. These are 1 gigawatt calculations. You'd have to start construction of a new nuclear power plant every 1.6 days. Not only would you have to start construction for the next every 1.6 days till 2050, you'd need to do that forever. Because the minute you decommissioned a plant, you'd have to have another one right next to it, ready to turn on instantly. So this would be forever. And that would generate 8 terawatts. Wind, if you look at all class 3, 4, or 5 terrestrial sites on the face of the planet, that will generate 2.1 terawatts, a great local solution. But maybe when you think about the whole global energy accounting spreadsheet, it's not the silver bullet. If you look at hydro, you go and dam every river again, that generates about 0.7 terawatts. And so you can see at this point, we've generated that 28 terawatts of power by 2050, but we're not eating. We've built 8,000 new nuclear power plants. We put windmills everywhere. I don't see a lot of huge problem with the windmills, but anyway, I think people are going to be hungry. So the first positive fact thus far, before you go and get all depressed, is that thankfully more solar energy hits the Earth's surface than humanity uses in a year. And I do have to say that I hadn't considered geothermal, and so from yesterday's talks, I realized that geothermal should be considered here. So when you think about the future, is that we need another 16 terawatts, and that's an absolute bottom basement value, because again, it's an unprecedented conservation. So we'll have 6 billion new users. Right now, about 3 billion people in the world use essentially zero energy, and this situation can't continue. There's a lot of reasons: economic, humanitarian, world security issues. And so these people, these 3 billion, are living basically off the grid or with very poor grid integration. And so legacy energy, that is large coal-burning power plants, nuclear power plants, may not be that feasible. And so when you think about balance of system limitations, is that we start to think about other types of non-grid sources of power. And so this is a picture that Mommy gave me yesterday, a picture from Senegal. And so this is a village that has no electricity and no grid connections of any kind. And so legacy energy is just not a feasible solution for this village at this time, if you'd like to really make an impact in the short term. And so there's something called personalized energy that's being bantered around in the energy community that I think is a very viable solution. And so it's grid-free. And this is kind of interesting because we in Canada and the United States, we're grid people in Europe. We live on the grid, and so in a sense our thinking is constrained by the grid. The grid is a great thing, and we're going to continue to use it. But for the vast majority of people in the world who are not on the grid, there are other, it frees you in your thinking, and so you can think of other things. And I'm wondering if the day will come when we grid people will say, darn, you know, if we could have done it all over again, we may have done it that way. So this is actually a chance, it's an opportunity. So when you compare existing storage methods, let's just think about how you would store energy if you were to use, for instance, solar energy, which I'll talk about in a second, is that our civilization was built on liquid fuels. And so cities like this were fueled on liquid fuels. And that part of the reason is that through storage in chemical bonds, which is the way a chemist sees it, is that you can store a lot of energy in a small amount of weight. And when you compare, I don't want to bore you with units, but you can see a lot of decimal points here when you look at, for instance, compressed air, 0 point something. Pumping water uphill, in fact, is very inefficient when you consider the mass of the water. Batteries, 0 point something. Capacitors, 0.0 something. So liquid fuels are very energy-rich, dense sources of fuel. And so things that people are considering is, and this is where talk is cheap sometimes, and these are just simply ideas that are being converted into reality in some places, and I'll tell you that in a second, is this idea of hydrogen, but hydrogen produced locally. And so if you'd like to form a liquid fuel, a nice place to look is water and the sun. And so if you were to take, for instance, the University of Alberta pool, this is 3 million liters of water, and you were to convert this pool to hydrogen in every second using light from the sun in order to split it, is that this would generate 42.7 terawatts. So if you were to distribute this, these 3 million liters all around the world, and this is assuming actually only 50% efficiency, very low efficiency numbers, but suddenly here's a number that makes me think, oh, thank goodness. So there's 43 terawatts right there, and you're going to be converting water using sunlight into hydrogen. And so the idea that's being bantered about, particularly by Toyota, Honda, and other places, is that your house is a power station. And so let's think of a Canadian house, which is going to be using a lot of power. We, in fact, use more than the Americans. If all the world wanted to live like Canada, we'd need 131 terawatts. And so by converting 3 gallons of water per day with a 5 by 6 square meter solar cell on the roof, and you to use cheap and easy to manufacture $10 a pound mass manufacturing, that's how much a Big Mac costs per pound, then could this, again, as I said before, talk is cheap, solar is not, but let's make it cheap, 1 cent per kilowatt hour, and this is in fact a company out of MIT called Sun Catalytics, and this is the vision that they're working with Tata, for instance, in India, the largest private multinational there, to turn into reality. So anyway, to finish up, this is some of our team. We actually, we make plastic solar cells. We're looking to mass manufacture them. We have a startup company here, but I think the most important part of my team is this. And so here we are at minus 27 degrees. Sometimes global warming doesn't seem so bad. But anyway, everybody looks pretty comfortable. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions later.
Thank you, Jillian. I love the last picture there. And now Alana Spiroguznik is going to talk to us about why he's excited about organic solar cells.
Hello, everybody. It's great to follow Jillian because some of the same themes are going to be mentioned again. So let's just begin actually with this graph that Jillian just showed you about world energy consumption. I'm going to introduce another unit to you, And this is a unit that I learned about a couple of months ago that I really like. It's called a cubic mile of oil. Okay? The amount of oil that we actually use that is listed there on the left, it's about a cubic mile of oil, which is equivalent to 1,500 stadiums. Okay? So the largest stadium in the world, the Beijing Olympic Stadium, is about twice of that. So imagine 800 Beijing Olympic stadiums full of oil, and that's just oil. Then you also have coal and gas, more or less at the same. So as Gillian was telling you, you need about 8,000 new power plants, 30% of the world's land mass, and all the hydro and wind that you can do, perhaps to fill this in. And the other option that we have is photovoltaics, right? We might want to cover, let's say, 0.2% of the Earth's surface running at 10% efficiency. Well, the issue is that basically pretty much is about every rooftop in the planet, 5 billion rooftops, and it will cost $80 trillion, okay? So what we're working on is actually, in my group, I'm trying to think about this vision, which is the idea of not trying to solve the whole energy problem. Let's think about solar cells that are very low cost and that can be deployed in places where there's no grid. For example, these are pictures from India and from Mexico, in places where you actually have organic solar cells that you can actually put in the top of a hut. They are very cheap to produce. And you can run from them, for example, organic light emitting diodes. So for example, here this lady is reading at night. From the same, you know, charge that you got from the device. You can actually weave the device, which is also pretty cool. So Sheila Kennedy from MIT, which is the one that provided these pictures, is actually working with these people to teach them how to incorporate them into the traditional materials to actually make cool things. For example, I can imagine a solar charging poncho for my iPhone. Okay, and this is a good example, right, of a guy charging his cell phone, which, as you know, enabling people with cell phones is actually one of the things that actually generates a lot of income. Another vision of Sheila that I really like is that you think about all these irregular rooftops, curtains, windows, all these surfaces that we might want to coat with solar. You might want to think about organic, because organic can be, for example, be that type of, you know, thing that you can roll out in a sunny day and roll in a rainy day. And I think this is an interesting vision that for organics. So now, what are organics? Okay, I'm a young faculty member. I want to work on something that is moving. Okay, so this is a very busy plot, but let me try to explain it to you. Here on the left, you have the efficiency, and here on the right, you have how long it has taken to achieve that efficiency. The green stuff here is actually silicon solar cells. They are about 15% efficient. It's taken a lot of time, like 25 years to get it there. Since I started being a professor, the community has been able to actually take these things from about 5% to 9%. Mitsubishi just announced 9%. So my group and I are working on how to make these things above 10% efficient in a fast way, as the fastest way possible. Okay? So let's see how these solar cells work. You have a device that is a transparent electrode, then you have a polymer blend, and then you have a reflective electrode. So light comes in and it hits these molecules and creates what is called an exciton, or an electronic excitation. An electron and a hole put together in a molecule, jumping slowly from one molecule to the other. Unlike silicon solar cells, it takes a while for this thing to jump from one place to the other. Then eventually, it finds this little C60 molecule called PCBM, a C60 derivative. And then the exciton dissociates into an electron and a hole that close a circuit and generate electricity. So there you go, there's the electron and the hole, they separate, they go to the two sides, close the circuit, generate electricity. So think about a very thin film of plastic that you can inkjet print or do roll-to-roll processing. Actually, this process was discovered at Kodak in the 80s, okay, this organic photovoltaic process. So they're pretty cool devices, and again, you can make them flexible. And the question is, what is the best molecule? This is the question I want to answer. So in collaboration with IBM, we're doing a project called the Clean Energy Project. Okay? So imagine that you have 3.5 million molecules that you want to screen for a 10% organic photovoltaic material. How can you help us do so? So what we do is we actually use the computing power from volunteer donors around the world to actually look at all these computers, at these molecules as fast as we can, to the tune of 20 to 40,000 molecules a day. Just this room, if all of you guys downloaded our screensaver after this, will probably provide us 400 new molecules. Okay? So I want you guys to download this, and people that are watching this, because you really help us screen 400 molecules more a day, okay, if all of you guys helped us. So imagine that you find the right molecule, okay? Then, of course, we'll probably give you a T-shirt or something. So this is our website. You can just go there, click on the Clean Energy Project, download now. That will take you to the IBM website, and off there you go, okay? So that's the kind of thing that we're trying to do. So now, one has to also not only talk, but walk the talk, right? So while we were building this, it took us many years to build this, and then in about a year and a half ago, we started computing with IBM, okay, this massive thing. But in the meantime, we were actually thinking, let's try to come up with a prediction in which we start with a computer and try to predict a good material. And in this case, this is for organic electronics, trying to make a computer out of plastic, which is also a very interesting device. Okay? So we started with this compound number one and said, let's try to make computational variations of this compound and see if we can find a cooler compound. Okay? So we actually found that this compound number two, by computer, okay, we predicted this was going to be very good. And then my colleague, Sergio Granado, started the synthesis. Shenan Bao at Stanford finished it. And when we actually characterized it, Michael Tony and Shenan Bao at Stanford, we found that this molecule is the second best organic semiconductor molecule for moving holes that is known. So we call this from in silico to carbon to device. Okay, so because we started in the computer, then this thing was synthesized, and now it has been tested in this device. And it was purple when it's in solution, so I really like that fact that our baby was purple. And this is actually the device. This is now the orange crystal of this molecule that we call DA2T, wired up and for mobility measurements. Okay. So again, this is has more mobility than amorphous silicon and was predicted with a computer and then verified experimentally. Why is this so important? Synthesizing a molecule is about a human year. So synthesizing the 1.9 million molecules that we have screened so far will be 1.9 million human years. So perhaps computation can help you screen faster. So I'm going to show you some of, just to end, let me show you some of the results of our group already. So we screened 1.9 million molecules. And what you see there is actually the most concentrated information of quantum chemistry data ever done. This is actually, it's a logarithmic plot. Basically, the darker you see the thing, okay, is the more number of molecules. Around here, each one of these hexagon has 40,000 molecules. Okay, so this is a diagram of two electronic properties of these polymers that could make them good organic solar cells. Okay, so turns out this region over here is about where they become 10% efficient. Okay, so turns out that at that region we find 25,000 molecules. We call it the billboard of organic photovoltaics. This summer we're going to publish a list of the top 1,000 for having our experimental colleagues test them. Some of them might not work, like in the pharmaceutical industry, when some theoretician predicts a good molecule for cancer or so on, it might not be the best molecule. So you might have to try, but at least now we have a way of ranking. Okay. Most of the organic photovoltaic materials that people do right now are about 6% efficient, and it's very nice that our theoretical predictions also have a maximum around 6% efficiency. So if you are like some sort of organic chemist trying to do something, you might more likely hit a 6% molecule. And 1 in 1,000, if you're lucky, you might hit a molecule that is, that's our prediction, you'll hit a molecule that is 10% efficient. Okay? So we're really trying to help experimentalists achieve this dream. Okay? So with that, I just want to tell you that the team is very large. This is the people in my research group that did this. We have people at UNAM in Mexico, my former advisor, Haverford College, Clark University, Stanford are the ones that make the materials. And the IBM component is really important, okay? Because IBM is the ones that actually help us deploy this over the grid. Lauren Kate made the videos. And don't forget to download here. I'm happy to answer your questions later as well. Thank you. Well done.
Thank you, Alain. There's how everyone can participate in saving the planet. And lastly, we're going to hear from Kathy Foley, who's going to tell us about the promise of superconductivity.
Thanks, Wilson. Well, so far we've been hearing about the different components. So yesterday we heard about energy generation, and today we've heard about storage and other solar photovoltaic devices. So I'm going to be looking at the glue that brings all these things together. But before we do that, I thought it was important to just go through and revisit the things that we learnt about in the video earlier this morning. Let's start with the power plant, which is then connected to the high voltage transmission lines, goes through the power substation, and then again goes through a transformer into the power poles that we all know and love and into our homes. When we look along the way about what happens, those wires are conductors which have a bit of resistance in them, and they heat up. Maybe not to the same extent as a bar radiator, but nevertheless we do lose energy along the way. So as we heard in the video this morning, that we lose about 65 to 70% of energy just where we make it. Then we go through stepping up the voltage to something higher so that it goes through transformers, goes through the transmission lines, and then steps down again. And in that process, we lose between 5 to 8% of the energy. And then we go through the power poles and into our house so that only a small amount of what is created is actually used by us. So, can we reduce those losses? Well, luckily, about 100 years ago, well, actually exactly 100 years ago, a fellow called Kamerlinger Onnes at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, and he's the fellow in the white outfit in the photograph here, did something where he got helium gas, the sort of stuff we have in those balloons that float away, and he passed the gas through a hole. And I can do an experiment now. When you go on your hand, it's warm. When you go like that, it cools it down. And when you pass a gas through a small hole, luckily for us, it actually cools the gas down. And if you do that over and over again, you can make a gas into a liquid. So 100 years ago, and it's a birthday this year, he did this and created liquid helium. And being a good solid-state physicist, he decided that it was important to go through and look at what happens when you cool metal down and see how its resistance changes. And something very unexpected happened. This is a graph that shows the resistance versus temperature. And at a very low temperature, he suddenly saw the resistance to electricity drop away to zero. This was the discovery of superconductivity, and he won a Nobel Prize because of that. And then, I guess since that time, you might not have come across it in a general sense, although anyone who has had magnetic resonant imaging measurement done to see whether they're sick or there's something wrong with their body will recognize this, because when you have a wire, you pass a current through it, it creates a magnetic field, which you probably learned about in high school. And if you make that into a coil, you're able to make an electromagnet. The more current you pass through, the bigger the current. And with MRI machines, if we didn't have superconducting wires, we would not be able to get the large magnetic fields we need to be able to do those measurements. So that's where you've come across superconductivity so far. Well, 25 years ago, something exciting happened. Up till now, we've been using liquid helium, which is very expensive. It's about, depending on what deal you can get with the supplier, somewhere between $20 and $80 a litre. And it's also a very rare material. In fact, helium is running out, and it's not very convenient to use. So 25 years ago, there was great excitement, because they found what's called, and especially, I guess, compared to winters in Canada, high temperature superconductivity was discovered. And it was high because we used liquid nitrogen. Now, liquid nitrogen, believe it or not, is very cheap, 13 cents a litre, cheaper than bottled water, milk, petrol, and so it's something that's readily available. And so it was so exciting that it was on the front page of Time magazine a few months later. And it's really interesting to look at that picture where we see a car plugged into a PowerPoint. And back then we thought that was hilarious, but now it's actually something we're really doing. Since the discovery of high-temperature superconductors, which can be cooled and get that zero resistance to the flow of electricity at that so-called high temperature of minus 200 degrees, you're able to create wires which are not easy to build, but they're quite complex. So this shows an example of one of the ones developed by American Superconductor. It has a copper coil core, and then it has a superconducting wire wrapped around it, and then the various different sheaths and things necessary, as well as a conduit which allows the nitrogen to pass through. With that, you're able to make a range of things, from magnets through to a range of power distributions. And this has been tested in many trial setups, and this is an example of one which was done by American Superconductor. And that's going through looking at how you can create distribution lines with zero loss. So if you were able to make a superconducting system which distributes our electricity from where we make it to where we use it, you can actually pass through a single wire a much larger amount of electricity. And so in the case of, say, built-up areas, such as cities, where we're getting them to be more and more dense, in order to be able to provide enough electricity to to be able to supply the growing demands, you can, in a smaller volume or a smaller real estate area, have a superconducting cable that replaces, as you can see here, a number of copper cables or overhead power supplies. So it also has another added advantage of less space as well as less loss. And if you look at the life cycle of from the time you actually start mining the metal materials, making the wires and implementing them all the way through, you can see comparing copper wire and niobium titanium, which is an example of, in this case, it's a low TC wire, it's you're able to see a comparison of the energy use. So you can see that it uses up over that period of time a lot less energy. The process of mining, you can see, is actually greater because there are more mine tailings, which means that there is a little bit more waste there. There is also more water usage required, but when you look at the carbon footprint, you can see that it's significantly lower, about an order of magnitude. So in the life cycle, it really makes it very interesting indeed. So it is possible to use superconductors for improving the generation and delivery of power in many ways. So I've gone through and identified from the generators themselves through to the transformers. You can actually make storage rings, transformers, motors, and the distribution lines themselves. So there's real opportunity there. But also superconductivity can be used for other things, including transport. This is the maglev train, which many of you probably have travelled on when you've been in Shanghai. It's the train that there goes at 300 kilometres an hour. It cost $18 million per kilometre to build, but it has very low emissions and is driven by linear motors. It's very quiet and energy efficient, although the energy efficiency also depends on what electrical power you use. Just last week, the Japanese government announced the plan to build another maglev train between Tokyo and Osaka. The train will travel at 600 kilometres an hour. It will cost 9 billion yen to trillion yen to build, and it's a public-private partnership which will be completed by 2018 to 2020. There's also the potential to use superconductors in creating efficient motors. And so this is the case in this cartoon here, where you see a conventional motor of 36.5 megawatts compared to a high TC motor of the same size. And with this, you can actually make $1 million saving per year in the fuel that is used to power, for example, a naval boat. There's also some other aspect which I guess we don't think about, where we waste a lot of energy, and that is when with computing. And this is the extreme version of what's called an exascale computer. At the moment, some of our biggest computers are called pentaflops, which have got a quadrillion number of bits in them and are able to do unbelievably fast computing processes. Well, this is 1,000 times faster. And some energy, and just last month, President Obama announced that he is putting $124 million into developing one of these computers, which I guess is going to allow us to solve many problems which we can't currently do. There comes a catch, though, and that is the energy required was originally thought to be around about 60 megawatts. Actually, when they redid the calculations, they found that the little power supply you need is actually 500 megawatts. Just to put that into context, the Fukushima nuclear reactor, which is going through all sorts of problems at the moment in Japan due to the tsunami and the earthquake, is of that order. So you would have to have your own nuclear power plant in order to run your little computer on the side. However, there's hope. Pentaflop level comparison here, you can see the most power efficient supercomputer today, which is the number two of the top 500 computers. It has 1.75 pentaflops, and it's has a, you can see there, a average power consumption of nearly 7 megawatts. And it requires about 1.7 megawatts for cooling. And it takes up a huge amount of space. However, if you were able to make a conceptual, or conceptually, if you made a supercomputer made out of superconducting components, the estimated power would be only 0.2 megawatts. And there would be no special facilities required. In fact, it would probably look like something where it's very compact indeed. And there's a picture to scale there, which has a, in that case, it looks like a dilution refrigerator, which is able to bring the temperature down. It's, although it can have simple cooling. I just want to finish off with two hybrid visions, which actually says, can we put this all together and come up with something which is pretty out there? So the first thing is this idea that's come from a range of different places, and it's called the Sahara Solar Breeder Model. And the idea is that we mine the sands in the Sahara Desert and extract the silica and make silicon photovoltaics. And then we use them to pump water from into the Sahara Desert to increase the arable land. And then we also use superconducting wires to be able to take that increasing solar power grid and be able to light up Europe. So that's one thing which is a little bit out there, but very exciting in a conceptual way. And then I apologise that this is not the clearest slide, but I just want to go through and show there is also the potential to use other coolants. So far we've talked about helium, which is minus 270 degrees. Liquid nitrogen, which is minus 200 degrees, but in between, there's you can cool hydrogen down, which is about minus 20 degrees. This is the idea of a continental supergrid, which is really out there. It's buried underground. It can potentially have hydrogen as a coolant there. You can use another superconductor. It's called a medium temperature superconductor called magnesium diboride, which will allow you to have the zero losses again, but also provide transport of hydrogen for applications, as we've heard, with hydrogen as a potential fuel for powering vehicles. And also adding to that underground, a maglev train, so that in one small tube under the ground you can have everything you need. The only problem is it comes with a bit of a price tag. It'll probably cost about $100 billion. In fact, it's worked out to be about $10 billion a year, and if you did that over 100 years, you'd have a fabulous system. Just to put that into context, though, the square kilometre array is going to be at about $1 billion. So it's not that completely outrageous. So let's just finish off with the consequences. The first one is that if we were going to use a superconducting grid to power all of the European Union, we could save 31 terawatt hours of electricity. That's about 1.2% of generation. In terms of emission, that's about 14.7 megatons of carbon dioxide, equivalent to about 20% of emissions. And this number only comes with the with a modelling that says that we only have about a 50% penetration over 20 years having market adoption. So when we look at superconductivity, even though it requires cooling, it could actually make a big impact on what we're trying to do to create the glue between all these different strategies we have to try and address what we're here to do today, and that is work out how we can have an energy future that is sustainable. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. Well done. Okay. Well, Kathy, I think I can say that was super. Let's explore the wider context now from the presentations and the challenges that we face in bringing efficiencies to the system. Linda, nanomaterials, they seem to offer a great deal of promise. Is there any hope that we might actually get it to match gasoline?
If you mean match in the sense of really becoming comparable, no.
So do we really
Mother Nature won't allow us to go there.
So physics and chemistry aren't cooperating. Can we punch through it, or do we need another approach to get beyond that? Because there's nothing that looks like it can match it at the moment, is there?
No, you saw the numbers, I presume. I think that one has to remind oneself is chemistry is, you know, it's based on the periodic table. You can't get around that. But nanomaterials can offer tremendous abilities to move beyond the batteries that we've had to a whole new generation of batteries. And if we can even get to 5 or 7 times the energy density of the ones that we have, that can make serious changes in the way that we use energy in terms of electric vehicles, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, and also, of course, for energy storage. But it's not ever going to, it's never going to achieve gasoline. I think I can say that with a fair degree of confidence. And to say otherwise would just be hype.
It would be hype, but I kept crossing my fingers, keep hoping.
Sorry.
Gillian, I love your vision of personalization of energy. So you're saying that we're stuck in a grid way of thinking, but once you're released from that, you can apply it across the world. But can we also apply it back home, back in Canada?
Oh, absolutely. When you think about home renovations, new construction, even in southern Alberta, we have a community that is entirely emissions-free, carbon neutral, Okotoks, Alberta, believe it or not. And so it is entirely possible, but integrating with existing structures will take some, will bring some costs.
So the promise is in the developing world, where you can start at this point rather than build a grid.
I think that will be faster. And then I think perhaps we'll have some non-grid envy that will encourage us to go that direction.
Alan, I love your vision. I also love all your graphics. You're obviously an in silico kind of guy. So tell me, is this approach not only possible for finding potential to build solar cells, but can it be applied to other elements of energy distribution or energy storage?
Actually, yes. I started thinking about that. I talked to a colleague in batteries, Professor Balsara at Berkeley. We were having a nice conversation the other day. I was thinking, can we apply this to polymer battery materials, for example? So yes, I think this combination, and Gerbrand said that MIT is trying to do this also for inorganic batteries. So there's many applications in which if you take advantage that the computing power has grown exponentially, okay, as was mentioned before, I mean, and combine it with high throughput theoretical, like us, computational screening of materials, and there are some approaches to also do it high throughput synthesis of the materials. I think this is a pathway for accelerating materials discovery that we need rather than testing one at a time. So I think this is a paradigm that people in the bio industry are very used to, and people in the materials are starting to do, but I think we need to just jump forward because, yeah.
And Kathy, I was fascinated to see how much power is going to be needed for that computer. But it's generally, our rate of use of computers is growing almost exponentially, it seems. So the superconductivity offer us a solution, or not a solution, some way to reduce carbon on an increasingly computer-driven world, web world.
Well, actually, yes, it's one of those things which is difficult to say which bit is using up the energy. So some people say the internet is increasing our use of energy significantly. It's actually not the flip-flops that actually make us be able to handle the data. It's the routing and all the stuff that supports it that is actually increasing the use of energy quite significantly. And in built-up areas, that's really the driver for the need for more power being bussed into high built-up areas.
Okay, now we're going to take some questions from our summit participants, and if we get time, we'll go to the public too. So have we got the first question? Just here in the front.
Hi, so this is a question. My name's Ted. I'm from Toronto. I'm a forum participant here at the summit. And the question is directed to all the nanoscientists on the panel. So one of the main appeals of today's solar photovoltaic technologies, beyond their ability to reduce carbon emissions, is their extreme high level of safety, which allows them to be deployed near where people live on rooftops in cities. I think one of the questions that a lot of the public will be interested in is, are there any safety implications for health or the environment of deployment of nanomaterials, a new emergent kind of technology on a global scale?
I'm going to take it.
Can I answer that? Because I actually run a nanosafety program. That's, One of the wonderful things about nanotechnology is that, particularly nanoparticles, is that you can actually manipulate the structure because to make something which in one shape and one material can be quite reactive and so could be leading down the pathway of being toxic. Yet the same material, a good example is rutile versus another structure. What is it?
Rutile?
Anatase. You can see I'm a physicist, not a chemist. And one is reactive and one is benign. And so all it is a structure. So in fact, nanotechnology, if you have it in one form, could be seen or could create concerns. But you can actually manipulate it or structure the particles, which are then adding to whether it's a printable inks that cause the printable electronics to make the solar cells benign. And so you get the same properties, but without that reactivity.
Do we have another question?
Thank you.
Just up there, the gentleman in the red tie.
Third of the way up.
Can't tell it right, it's not toxic.
White light.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Aaron Leopold. I'm also in the forum. I have a question about the industry partnerships that you guys are working with, or if you're working with industry partners, because obviously the idea of transporting these organic or non-organic solar cells, which are very cheap, to the developing world is something that everyone is probably very, very much in favor of, but at the same time, getting them there is something else. And we know that the industry to date has focused really on northern markets, on wealthy markets, and what's the incentive, or who are you working with to kind of bridge this kind of customer gap, change the customer base of these companies?
Well, I guess I'm going to answer just in my case. Because I've been kind of in the closet computing for a while and finally coming out with results. I have talked, for example, the company that makes the acceptor, that fullerene molecule that you saw, that round molecule, they're interested in finding out what's the next best acceptor, and we might help them computationally. Companies that do this transition, I haven't, but Sheila Kennedy, the person that did the pictures in the beginning of my talk, she's an architect. She's thinking about how to build things that are useful for people, and I would imagine that there are companies that will fill this gap soon. I mean, Jillian has a startup. She probably can tell us more about that.
And that's the goal.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about particularly the printable photovoltaics, there are versions which can be just printed using a converted bubble jet printer,
that's
which means that you've got quite low tech techniques, which doesn't require
That's the visual graphic.
the huge infrastructure that the silicon technology needs. And so, in fact, in many ways, some of these things are absolutely ideal for developing nations because it doesn't require that huge infrastructure of clean rooms and all the equipment that goes with it. Just need a desktop converted crummy bubble jet printer, and voila.
Or more massively, I think the Konarka factory in Massachusetts, actually, I have not talked to that company yet. These are the ones that make the most, they are the one that makes most organic solar cells. They actually, I think, retooled a Kodak type, a factory for
film.
For film, mm-hmm. So I've seen pictures of it. It's kind of like this roll-to-roll processing with very few, few grams of material for a lot of area.
Think of the way newspapers are made, and that's the goal.
In terms of battery manufacture, one really does have to work fairly closely with industry, mostly because one can only develop certain parts of those components of the cell, and it really requires a lot of pulling it together in order to make it to work at a large scale. So not to say that small startup companies can't be successful, there have been a few examples of them, not so many, so it really is advantageous to work with companies for that. But the ideas generally come at the bottom level.
We have a question from Barry Brook.
From the University of Adelaide in Australia. That figure of 30 terawatts of energy demand is impressive, certainly. But I should point out that's primary energy rather than final energy. So if you took 8,000 nuclear power plants, for instance, that's electrical energy, that's final energy, that produces about 24 terawatts of primary energy. So you've almost got to your 30 terawatt goal. So I thought I should just pitch in for nuclear and say it's not actually as bad as it looks, about three times better.
Yeah, the 30 terawatt, I agree that there was a discrepancy between a lot of the units, but the 30 terawatts, I think, is the final use. But, okay, we can talk about it.
What's a couple of terawatts between friends? I have a question from Jason.
Hi, Jason Blackstock, I'm one of the advisors for the conference. You talked about the legacy system that we have in terms of fossil fuels, but for each of the technologies that you were talking about, the difficulty in integrating it into our energy system is in part related to the legacy grid that we have and the legacy system we have of distributing it. And I wanted to just ask, what are the strategies of dealing with the utility companies, with the embedded structure that has its own momentum, in order to begin bringing some of these technologies in? Where are the soft points or the real opportunity points in the gridded system where all the power is currently being used and producing most of the fossil fuels to integrate these technologies?
I actually don't want to work with the grid right now. I think that's for a number of reasons. One, I think it's a huge opportunity, both humanitarian and economic, and so I think that right now focusing on the very inexpensive, just unroll the plastic solar cells, being able to carry them because they're lightweight, long distance, that's been our focus. You can't do everything all at once.
I guess that's where superconductivity is really useful. particularly in built-up areas and particularly in highly in dense populated areas where you have high rise and that sort of thing, in order to provide enough electricity, real estate becomes really a big deal then. And currently, we don't realise that most of our power lines that supply our buildings in built-up cities have quite complex cooling because they do get hot, and it's not that different or difficult to swap over to something which is cryogenically cooled, and it actually can do a refit. And with that, they get better capacity because, as I showed in my slides, that one superconducting wire is about 10 times more copper wires, and so therefore you're able to get improve your capacity. So there's actually a cost-benefit analysis or benefit for power companies when they're running out of just real estate, and it's pretty expensive in places like New York and Tokyo to actually buy the properties they need to be able to pump the stuff through. So there's a good reason for it. And continuous energy supply in a city is absolutely critical for a robust economy. Everyone knows that I think in California there's been some power outages over the time, and I guess in Tokyo just after the earthquake there. Absolutely devastates the economy when you actually start having power outages and you start drifting into something which is heading towards a downward spiral. And so continuous supply is essential, and that's a good motivator.
Okay. Sir, you have a question.
This morning, I'm Ron MacArthur from Ottawa, Canada, also a forum member. My question is, we all have our roles or day jobs that we go back to, and being a researcher is a lot of work. It takes a lot of dedication, a lot of time. My question is, what do you feel as researchers is your level of contribution to the commercialization of these technologies that you're working with? Where do you see your role ending and industry and society picking it up from there?
I think that depends on the technology that one is addressing. Some are easy to contribute to at a ground level, and others you can take all the way to the very end. So it's very dependent on what one is working on. Any one of us, I think, can do a startup, and some of us have. So could you be a bit more specific about?
The big thing that I worry about a number of things. I worry about societal implications of the research that we do. I would like to have a positive impact. I also think about my students, and I want them to have jobs. And let's face it, in Canada, our high technological base is fairly sparse. There aren't a lot of high-tech jobs for us. You know, there's research in motion here, and other than that, you know, you're kind of going down the list. So the fact that I have three extremely entrepreneurial students who have taken every single possible graduate management class that they can, every single executive course, working closely with our business management people and our, what we call Tech Edmonton, to make this a reality, they're making jobs for themselves in something that I think is important for diversification, the economy, et cetera, et cetera. So I kind of just support them now and stand back.
Zoe, you have a question. Member of the forum.
Hi, I'm Zoe Heron, forum here in Canada. And perhaps this most applies to Jillian, but if it applies to the rest of you, please feel free to answer. Is there a way for anyone in this room to support the work that you're doing? I don't know if a way currently exists, whether it's, I don't know, financial or using your time. Like, how can everyday people support the work that you are doing to help move it forward?
Get the message out. Just pass the message on, because I think that when you're thinking about all the different energy sources and the idea of having energy that is not necessarily tied in with the grid, there are lots of papers out there, lots of publications. Who reads them? I mean, really?
But I mean, there's a lot of ways you can help if you are in the NGO world like you. For example, I would love to have, your NGO announce, download the screensaver of the Clean Energy Project, right? Even things like that, just partnering with you guys to make awareness for the stuff that we are having a distributed supercomputing. Our cooling is distributed. We don't need to worry about these terawatts of cooling because your laptop is cooled by your legs, right? Another thing that is important is that NGOs can be able to come up with ideas like Sheila's, like how to use the OPVs in the outer world. And I mean, as somebody was asking earlier, I mean, the job of the scientist is concentrated on the research. We can spin off some things or start help some startups. But there's a moment in which somebody else has to pick it up, and that's where I think you guys can help.
The other place is probably when you're putting in grants, let Zoe know, and she can put some placards and a bunch of people outside the granting agencies.
Please.
Get them to focus. How do you like that? Do we have some other questions? Just here. Yes, Jatin.
Jatin Nathwani, I'm a member of the advisor to the forum as well. A question I wanted to press on and maybe point out here is this, what I believe to be nearly transformational, the kind of stuff that Gillian is talking about. This is the notion of self-contained, renewable microgrids that would be supported, off-grids, if you wish. And it's not only just the large need in the emerging economies and the developing parts of the world, but at our home here too, working with our First Nations communities, which are
exactly
off-grid, and we are working on not only the technology and the power system part that supports it, but of course the generation technology.
Exactly.
But this is and can be truly transformational in the way we think about how energy is generated, distributed to people where
Agree
they are.
Entirely.
Thank you.
That's a big tick there from Jatin, I think.
Yeah.
Do we have questions? Should I invite the public, perhaps? Oh, no, there's a gentleman here, just here. Please, go ahead. You're a member of the forum, yeah?
This question is directed towards Kathy. You mentioned that there's a pilot station. I think there's a few pilot stations with superconductors currently under test. Do you think that there'll be more stations? Because this is a well-developed grid, I assume, for Canada. So do you think there'll be more pilot stations in other countries, like developing grid countries, or do you think there'll be more pilot stations in a well-developed infrastructure like Canada?
Well, the different superconducting technologies are at different stages of development. So I think the power distribution is probably the best developed at this stage other than the maglev train. So just looking at power distribution, it's one of the reasons why it hasn't taken off has more to do with the price point, and I imagine that's all around the government policy as to how they want to price the way we handle anything to do with carbon dioxide. So until governments actually make policies that drive the real cost of how we live and the consequences of just using our traditional approaches, that's probably going to make it difficult to be adopted, unless there's that economic one I referred to before. But then when you're talking about, though, are we going to be setting up, say, Africa with a superconducting grid? I think it's probably unlikely. And that's where, as you've heard it many times during this summit, that I think it's not going to be a single uniform and universal approach to dealing with energy supply. When you've got countries which don't have any grid systems, there is a real opportunity to have a blank piece of paper and say, what is it that we should be coming up with, which is the ideal design for it, and distributed energy or electricity, which is independent of a grid, is something that's really a possibility, with maybe hubs where you want to be able to have enough energy to or power provision for industry in a particular area. You don't want to deny them that opportunity. And then if you look at many built-up areas, then where it would be very difficult to get rid of the current process that we do use and introduce a new one, that will basically be a good opportunity to consider using superconducting cables or technologies, because it does have a lot to offer.
Before we go to the next question, one thing I wanted to ask, you mentioned that MRIs obviously create large magnetic fields. Are there any issues with creating power, you talked about Tokyo or New York, creating power in substations using superconductivity. Are there any issues around high magnetic fields?
No more than we currently have. What you've got is just low loss. And so at the moment, yes, whenever you have a magnetic current, even from your brain and your heart, there's a magnetic field associated with it. So we live in a magnetic field and our bodies are able to cope with it. So long as it doesn't change too fast and it's not too great and you're not wearing a pacemaker, you're fine.
Wow, there you go. Don't think I'm wearing a pacemaker, but apparently I have a magnetic heart. Sir, you have a question.
Hi, I'm Gerard Goodell. I'm a local. I'm not part of the team here. I was wondering, Kathy...
Can you hold up your microphone? Sorry, so we can hear you.
I was wondering, Kathy, you talk a lot about traditional superconductors, cooled superconductors. Do you do any work, or do you...
Could you put up a little bit higher? We still can't hear you, sorry.
Sorry. Do you do any work, or do you have any opinion on ballistic superconductors for power transmission over long distances?
For what sort of super, ballistic?
Ballistic superconductors, they're macromolecules that have one resistance, regardless of their length.
I haven't done any work on that, and I really don't know much about it. It's not something that is being worked on in the sense of being a being a material or some a substance that can be used in a power application. At this stage, ballistic, if I think I know what you're referring to, it is still pretty much an experimental concept.
Thank you very much. We have another questions? Another question? Towards the back, perhaps. You guys have been rather quiet. Let's get you asking some questions.
Oh, got one up here, roll nine.
You might have to stand up if you've got it, because I can't see you. Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
Hi there, my name's Joel. I'm another member of the public and very interested in all of this. Of all the really neat ideas you guys brought forward, how many years are we from market entry for each of these different kind of exciting options?
In my area, it takes anywhere between 10 and 15 years for an idea actually to make it into the market in a commercializable sense. That has been roughly how it's been for the material that I talked about, the lithium iron phosphate, that was first developed in 1997. And so it was commercialized on a small scale in about 2007, and it's just starting to really make an impact on a larger scale now. So again, that's, I guess, dependent on every technology. I'll let the other speakers address that, but it's slow in this business.
Plastic OPVs haven't been, or organic photovoltaics, I should say, solar cells, haven't been commercialized yet. Bunch of companies, Kanarka being the most well-known, are poised to commercialize, and we're aiming for 2015 ourselves. Sun Catalytics, working with Tata Industries in India, is aiming for 18-month unrolling, not of based on organic photovoltaics, but other types of generation one, generation two, silicon-based and thin film technologies, 18 months for the off-grid implementation in India.
I just want to point out for organics, there is this floating number of 10% efficiency to be commercializable. And right now I tell you, Mitsubishi said 9.1% in a lab. So it's getting close. I mean, that's a lab, that's a very different than a regular sale when you produce it. But that tells you that things are coming up close to where organics, like 2015, I agree, seems like a nice number.
And just, yeah. I guess just to finish off in large scale, superconductors, the wires and tapes for power distribution are there. Send in your order, and I'm sure American Superconductor will deliver it to you. And then other large scale items are at various stages of development. Some are commercially available. The motors for shipping are being used now, particularly in defense. And you can buy your own maglev train, I guess, if you have 9 trillion yen too. With the computing side of things, we've got to remember that silicon technology started just after World War II, and now we're going to get to a point where it's almost at the atomic level for being able to deal with Moore's law and being able to create the sort of computers that we deal with on a daily basis. Superconducting electronics was really discovered in the 70s, and so it's about nearly 40 years old. So it's another 20 years, I think, before we'll see superconducting electronics becoming something which will be in your next laptop. But it will happen.
And I'd just like to add the point that, at least with respect to energy storage, the drivers that we've had, which has mostly been portable electronics, are quite different from the ones that are going to be driving the market in the next, say, 5 to 10 years. So those demands for grid storage, for example, are going to change
the
pace at which things are developed quite substantially. And sorry, I keep coughing.
That's
it's really hard to factor
point.
That in.
Actually, that's a really important point, and that is that our mobile phones and electronics, we turn them over every 6 months. 3 years is a long time to own your own computer, and then you think it's a dinosaur. And so we have this mentality that stuff, and particularly technologies, turn over really quickly. But infrastructure, whether it's transport or particularly power stations, they actually have a 50-plus lifetime. So when we do our thinking about really what are we going to be doing in 2030, we really have to be realistic about what is going to be the turnover time rate for some of those huge investments. I'm not sure too many industries or governments are in a position to buy them out and say, let's just replace one with another before the end of their lifetime.
We've got a question here from Lauren in the front row.
Hi, my name is Lauren. I'm a foreign member from the United States. And my question is, I feel like there's sort of an elephant in the room here. A number of times throughout the summit, I've heard the issue of 65% of heat being lost through power plants. And why isn't the cogeneration or recycled heat being talked about more in these conversations as part of the system or being used more widely as a technology?
Well, perhaps if you had a scientist that does that in the panel, could talk more about that, right? Yeah.
There is an issue, and that it's and that's the idea of using heat and turning into electricity, or using heat in some way to be able to be recycled. And part of it has to do with when you have something that's hot, you usually don't just have it so that the heat's something you can then bottle up and then use somewhere else. And so it's often got lots of insulators around it and set up in a way where you don't even want to have water going past it because it might cause problems. So taking an existing power generation system and then introducing another technology into that to suck out the heat is actually not easy to couple that heat into whatever it is that's using it. And that's one of the big issues. It's something we were talking about yesterday in some of the small sessions in the forum. The reality is big infrastructure. You don't want to go in and drill holes and stuff and put pipes in and pipe it out unless there's a really good economic reason for it, and also that you're not going to interrupt the supply because there's no real economic driver to do that. And so it's all about a mixture of getting the technology right so that you can couple the heat and use it, but the other is, again, having this economic driver so that people are willing to do it and take that risk.
So it's another infrastructure issue. I think we'll take our last question, and that will be from, do we have someone? Anyone? I feel like I'm in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Oh, yes, we have a question just there.
Geothermal guy.
It's Craig Dunn. I'm from Calgary, Canada. I just had a question. We refer to industry sort of as another place or space, and the questions come up. In terms of like generation and power going forward, how do you engage more of the business types, the more entrepreneurial characters, to move quicker to adoption in terms of bringing some of this technology to bear?
I think that if you have a great technology, very little encouragement is actually necessary. they will tend to jump on it.
You have some experience in that area, Kathy, trying to get business on board.
At least universities are moving more towards these models of how to approach a business, and at least my university has a lot of programs that are being just started and so on for transitioning the technologies, transitioning, for example, in the medical side is very advanced, in our side it also exists. So there are venues or possibilities of engaging, for example, in our case, a lot of the venture capitalists and so on that are in Kendall Square, just close to us, for example.
Actually, one of our eminent people from Waterloo, whose name I can't remember, I apologise, Tom somebody or another, he actually said something which has really had a big impact on me, and that is one of the things we don't value is the importance of the innovation in the business model to make a technology work. And you just have to look at things from the way iPods and iPhones were working, setting up iTunes as a way to make that in. And I guess the other one is he used the example of Amazon Books, where they don't make money out of selling your books. They make money by getting your money early and then investing it for the period of time when they have it in their pocket before they sell it, give it on to whoever they're meant to pay when they pay their bills. So I think one of the things which we need as researchers and innovators is to actually recognize and appreciate and work with entrepreneurs and industry and people who are there to put their money down to take a technology and recognize and appreciate and probably they also need to think as their innovation and contribution is the business model and the financial model to make it actually happen. And I suspect that all the different things we've been hearing about will probably all need very different business models to be successful.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen, another fabulous panel on day two of the Equinox Summit plenary session. Please thank them for me. They are Linda Nazar.
I'm clapping for you guys.
Thank you.
Linda Nazar, Gillian Burek, Alan Espiro-Guzik, and Kathy Foley. Our summit participants will soon adjourn to sift through these ideas and discuss how to bring them into reality. This is actually the hard work. We had a good day yesterday, but we are progressing. We've got to work through. There's some serious challenges here. For those of you online, the next public lecture is later today. The speaker is Thomas Homer Dixon, the CG Chair of Global Systems at the Bazilli School of International Affairs here in Waterloo. He's also a professor at the University of Waterloo. His talk is entitled Energy, Complexity and Human Survival. Don't forget the agenda at 8 p.m. tonight. If you saw last night, you would have seen a frank and fearless debate and also quite a bit of fun. You can find details of all of this at wgsi.org or tvo.org. Thank you for taking part, and we'll see you tomorrow.